train for the next. The last speaker today is William Stein from the University of Washington, who will talk about writing the book, Prime Numbers and the Riemann Hypothesis, with Baron Nathan.
So I'll be talking about writing a book over the last several years with Barry. And first, of course, thank you, Barry, for being here. And also, of course, great thanks to the organizers for putting this together and for asking the speakers when they wanted to talk. I thought that was a nice touch. I think the only complaint I have about the conference is Barry is giving a talk. I love listening to this talk. But that's the way such conferences are. Also, I want to encourage you in the audience to, if you feel like rudely interrupting me, just go for it. You don't have to wait until the end to ask questions or anything like that. So as a prelude, if you're going to take away one little thing from the talk, collaborate with great co-authors. So back in 1999, one of my first experiences with this was Helena Verrall and I were typing up John Tate's lecture notes, and we decided to make them really, really polished. And we ended up, so she flew off, so it was all left on my shoulders. And I was sitting in the computer lab a lot, closely working with John Tate, figuring out exactly how to write up his notes and having him go over drafts. And then at lunch, David Savitt walked up to me and he said, "Everybody is so jealous of you getting to talk with John Tate." And so, so it really was a fantastic experience. I mean, my name's not on the paper or anything, but it's really, really amazing if you have the opportunity ever to write something with or for a great person, just go for it, take it. And the next thing I did was wrote like a 70 or 80 page paper with Ken Ribbett about all of his stuff from PCMI, again, taking this lesson. And this talk is about yet another instance of this. So here's an overview of the talk. So first I'll talk about a public lecture that Barry gave in 2005 at MIT that was sponsored by the Clay Math Institute. So it was a big deal with a banquet by Clay and a lecture and so on. And I helped a lot with the preparation of that. And then writing a book that was inspired by that lecture. And then there's another step after writing a book that you may or may not do, which is actually publishing the book. So I'll talk about all three steps. And there's a lot of tension between each of these steps as you go. So first, section one, Barry's public lecture. So here's Barry. I couldn't find a picture from 2005 when he was giving the lecture, but he gave another lecture about much the same thing at MSRI in 2015, I think, or 2014. There he is. He looks exactly the same as in 2005, and today, of course. Okay, so here's the lecture. It was called, "Are There Still Unsolved Problems About the Numbers 1, 2, 3, 4? So it's the sort of thing that, if you maybe talk to the barista at the coffee shop over here, they might not know whether or not there are unsolved problems about these numbers. And the idea was to talk about prime numbers and use them as a hook to sell a general audience on number theory. Prime numbers are immediately accessible, they're interesting, I know there's a typo there, and there's two typos, okay, sorry, and erratic primes. The thing with primes is you think things are going nicely and then chaos happens, as illustrated. So there's other natural phenomena like cicadas. For them, their lives maybe depend on prime numbers. They seem to come out exactly every once in a while during prime years. And there's lots and lots of examples of interesting open problems that you can explain to anybody involving prime numbers. And moreover, people can do computations of their own. They can write a little program and discover new things, really get into it. And in fact, you'll have to ask Barry about this, but he told me that he got his father very much into the Goldbach conjecture, who had not really had much interest in mathematics before that. So he thought primes would work. I had just launched Sage a few months before, and so I did a lot of calculations and drew pictures for the talk using Sage, and this really influenced a lot of the early development of Sage. For example, I wrote a bridge between Sage and Mathematica because I needed to evaluate the incomplete gamma function for some plots that we were drawing. And there was no open source incomplete gamma function available. It wasn't in Perry, they just had the basic gamma function and so on. And there was some visualization functionality, a bunch of prime enumeration, and all kinds of little programs that I wrote. So what was in Barry's lecture? So he talked about integer factorization, talked a bit about the largest known prime number. It's always fun talking about that because, like in our book, we had to have a section about the largest known prime number, and we've had to update it like 4 times as we were writing the book. And hopefully it's totally out of date by now. I think it is. But if anyone's ever written about the largest known prime number, you'll know that they just keep coming. It's also an amazing topic just because there is a largest known prime number, but there's, of course, it's easy to see that there's no largest prime number. So we talked about the twin primes conjecture, about the problem of counting primes, enumerating them, and then the prime number theorem, but from the perspective of it being first a conjecture of Gauss, which is, of course, later proved. And then finally, Riemann's idea, which is, of course, central to this book and the whole talk, which is about how to approximate pi of x, the number of primes up to x, by increasingly, well, by a smooth function or a sum of smooth functions. So I'll say much more about that. So that's what the lecture was about. These were the topics. And as I say at the bottom, it worked. So you gave the talk, their feedback was really good. It seemed to really work. Okay, so that's part one. Next, we decided, as many people have done and possibly regretted it, we decided to write a book. So Barry said, let's write a book. And fortunately, though, we weren't too ambitious. Like, we didn't even think about whether it would be something we publish with a publisher or we just put on our website or whatever. And that really took a lot of the stress out of it and made it fun, which is a theme you've seen repeatedly in the lecture so far as Barry looks for the fun thing to do in math. So the idea was, could we turn this public lecture into a popular book and make it something that, like the public lectures, for a general audience? We wanted to make the book physically small and readable, so not some like 500-page tome on the Riemann hypothesis. And another thing, we wanted to make it very much focused on mathematics rather than stories of people. So for example, ask yourself, do you know how old Riemann was when he died? And under what circumstances? So some people know, some people don't. Do you know why he died? I asked somebody earlier today, and they said, probably either 40 or 80. So that, I mean, questions like that, they're fascinating, wonderful, exciting. You'll find nothing about that in our book. That's not what our book is about. So there are lots of other books on the Riemann hypothesis that will tell all kinds of great stories, and it's fascinating stuff, but that's just not what this book is about. We wanted to profusely illustrate it because we felt that from the public lecture, that was one of the things that really connected with people and really drove what we did. So we decided to meet for a few weeks in his country house and focus on the book and nothing else. And we did that. And one of the first questions was, what kind of book, you know, would this be? And as I mentioned before, there's already a bunch of books on the Riemann hypothesis. So how could we do something that is worth doing that's unique? I've also, by the way, written a book on elementary number theory, which, I don't know, has anyone else in the room written a book on elementary number theory? There's a lot of books on elementary number theory. So I only published a book on elementary number theory because Dick Gross convinced me I should. So, but, you know, you have to find some unique angle. So as I mentioned, there's one thing motivated by math and not stories. The other thing is that Barry had been thinking about the problem of how explicit is the explicit formula. And we thought maybe we could somehow work that question, which has many interesting sort of problems still to be solved about it, into our popular exposition. So two of the books we kind of thought about were one called The Education of T.C. Mitz. T.C. Mitz means the celebrated man in the street, which some people grew up reading, say, that book, and I don't know how big it is physically. Is it like on bullshit, or is it a lot bigger? It's regular size. Okay, so like in the picture, it's regular size.
Most of the books are now back in print, finally.
Yes, yeah. Wonderful. So, but the point of the books are not, you know, huge 500-page tomes or something like that. There's also another very small book on bullshit, which is, as you can see, much smaller than, well, than the T.C. Mitz book. So we didn't really know which size book we wanted to make. Maybe a really tiny one you could stick in your pocket, or a bigger one, or a much, much bigger one. But we definitely did not want it to be too big. So something that you could sit down and actually read from cover to cover. That was the idea. And our approach, which I'll go into much more detail in the middle of this talk, was to kind of go back 150 years and really focus on real Fourier analysis rather than complex analysis. So in the book itself, we don't mention complex numbers until the very, very end. So, and then finally, the target audience for the book. So there's just a bunch of questions you ask when you're thinking of writing a book. So I said a general audience, but we ended up focusing on two groups, bright high school students and our imaginary retired electrical engineers. So they're the ones who really love mathematics, but they, you know, like pure mathematics, but they spend a lot of time doing, you know, applied mathematics during their life. I mean, personally, I was a computer science undergraduate, and then I was forced to take an electrical engineering class, and I found the math in the class so beautiful that that was one of the things that pushed me to switch to mathematics as a major, as an undergrad. So, these were two. So, for example, I took the material from the lecture, and I taught it to a bunch of high school students at a summer program at University of Washington, and it worked really well with that class. And yeah, so those were our target audience people. And computing with Sage, so Sage continued to develop over the years as we were writing the book, and it really drove the exposition. We wrote a lot of code and drew plots, and it was really amazing to see, we'd have an idea kind of in theory, and then we would draw a plot, and it would really, really clearly illustrate the idea, much more than we expected, but then it would also suggest a bunch of questions, and it really drove the exposition. The central point of the book, which I'll come back to repeatedly, is that there is a discrete distribution on the prime powers, and if you compute explicitly its Fourier transform, it looks like a discrete distribution, so a function with a bunch of spikes, exactly at the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. And conversely, if you take this distribution that you get, which has spikes at the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, and Fourier transform it back, and then just draw a plot, it looks like something that has spikes exactly at the prime powers.
Are you saying that it shouldn't be Riemann hypothesis?
Should it be imaginary parts? No, I'm saying that if you define each of these quantities and then approximate them on a computer and draw a plot, the picture suggests this.
So
what we do in the book is, without using any complex numbers, we describe each of these objects in a very natural way, and I will show you the plots of that. And then you know, you just look and you see very visibly this relationship. It's really the explicit formula, but made in a way that anyone could reproduce and meant to be much more accessible. Taking a step back, technically, we were working on the book, so we were writing a lot of LaTeX, and I wrote a LaTeX editor which ran in a web browser and was collaborative. So Barry could be editing the book, and I could see him editing the book, and conversely, and it was also set up so that, you know, anyone could just look at the current, literally like within the last few minutes, draft of the book. CoCalc is this website. It was called Sage Math Cloud when we were writing the book, which lets you use Sage and LaTeX together in the same place. So as we're writing the book, we could run code in Sage in these worksheets. It would create output that would then just appear inside of the book itself automatically. So we had the technical writing of the book in the exact same place as all the computations related to the book. And Barry, if you've ever wondered, has Barry spent a lot of time staring at Python code? He shakes his head, but it's true. I've walked him through line by line, reading. He doesn't write the code, but he definitely can read Python code very well. So here's what the collaborative editor looks like. It's kind of washed out, unfortunately, because I wanted to tell you a little bit of what's there. But I guess there's nothing I can, do about that. This is just tech on the left. On the right is one of the pages from the book, and that's a picture you can barely tell of Don Zagier. And the quote below him is this beautiful quote from a paper he wrote called the first 50 million prime numbers. And it really inspired Barry's lecture, which inspired the book. By the way, this picture, I was going on a walk with Don at Oberwolfach, and I just kind of jumped out in front of him and took this picture. So a number of the pictures were ones that I, as a brand new postdoc, kind of jumped out and took. And this is another picture. Again, it's kind of washed out, but here, this is a Sage worksheet drawing a plot. And then here's the LaTeX editor in a web browser writing the talk that I'm giving right now. So, okay. So the next thing I'm going to do is tell you really the core content of the book. So what we do in the book is we state the Riemann hypothesis in four equivalent ways and then try to motivate each of the statements. And I'm just going to run through each of those four equivalent statements, because that's really what the book hangs around. Before doing that, though, just a reminder, the main problem that the book is about is counting primes. So it's the question of, if you let pi of x be the number of primes up to x, then give a good approximation for pi of x. There's a plot of pi of x, and it looks pretty chunky. It looks like a staircase as it goes up. Of course, the first jump is at 2, then at 3. Each time it goes up by exactly 1. Okay. The neat thing is if you move out a little bit, so here's the same plot but up to 1,000, it starts to look a little bit less chunky from a distance. And if you go out to 1,000,000, it's the same kind of plot but now up to 1,000,000, it looks like a nice smooth curve. So the problem is to give a nice, is to give a really good approximation to that curve, where good is something to be made precise. So here's the first, and this is, of course, a problem people thought about for a long time. So here is the first formulation we arrive at in the book after a lot of discussion of other things, which is define lie of x to be the integral from 2 to x of 1 over log of t dt. And then this is a good approximation to pi of x in the following sense. If you choose any value of x at all and evaluate lie at that number and pi at that number, then roughly the first half of the digits will be the same of those two numbers. So let me see if, I wonder. Good, that worked. So I zoomed in. Right there in the upper right, I've evaluated pi and lie. Well, I didn't do it. Somebody evaluated pi and lie at 10 to the power of 24, which is an enormous value. Lie, of course, is easy to evaluate at such a big value, but pi, well, that was extremely hard work. Notice, though, that the first half of the digits of those two numbers are the same. In contrast, the prime number theorem tells you that x over log x, or equivalently x over log x minus 1, is asymptotic to pi of x, and that's a theorem. But that doesn't tell you anything about how many digits match up. It just says that if you take the quotient and take the limit, it goes to 1. And you'll see that only 3 of the digits match up between x over log x minus 1 and pi of x. So here's our, So here's our statement of the Riemann hypothesis, the first one. The number of primes of x is approximately lie of x, in the sense of essentially square root accurate. That is, the difference of the two numbers is less than or equal to root x log x. Or, very vaguely, the first half of the digits are the same. And a little bit of motivation for this. So Gauss spent a long time counting all of the primes up to 3,000,000. And he He worked, so he finally arrived, he wrote a letter to somebody, he said, I finally did it, I've counted the primes up to 3 million, loosely translated, and it's 216,745. It turns out, though, that he made a couple of mistakes as he went. You know, like, unless you're perfect, like a computer is almost perfect, you'll make a couple of mistakes, and he ended up making just enough mistakes to mess up half of the digits. So the actual number of primes, 216,816. Even computers will make little mistakes if you let them run for a long time, but there's very, very good checksums and all kinds of, you know, double checks on the memory that you use. But cosmic radiation will randomly flip, you know, the bits in a computer. So similarly, I suppose if you went far enough doing a similar calculation, even with a really good computer, it could fail. It might take, you know, billions of years to see the failure. But you expect with some constant that if you are very, very careful, you're going to mess up about half the digits. And so that's what we mean by this essentially square root approximation. This is much, much better than what you get from the prime number theorem. And it's equivalent to other formulations of the Riemann hypothesis. Okay, first one. Second one. So let's replace the staircase of primes that I defined before, just pi of x, so the function that goes up by one at each prime, by something slightly different. Instead of going up at each prime, we'll make the staircase go up at each prime power. I'll just call this the prime power staircase. The other difference is at the prime power one, it goes up by log of 2 pi, and at the other prime powers, at p to the n, it goes up by log of p. Okay? And here it is. So I'll zoom in for a moment. At the one on the left, at 1, it goes up by log of 2 pi. And then at 2, it goes up by log of 2. And then at 3, it goes up by log of 3. At 4, it goes up by log of 2 again. OK? So it's just a staircase, but it takes into account prime powers instead of primes. Looking at this staircase, what function do you imagine that maybe in the limit would approximate it? It's just like y equals x, f of x equals x. So that is, oops, sorry about that. That is our second formulation of the Riemann hypothesis. The prime power staircase, psi of x, is essentially square root close to the 45 degree straight line. So it's equivalent to approximating pi of x by li of x, but a little bit more immediate. But on the other hand, it's weird because you have prime powers. Yes?
Okay, so I recognize the like von Mandel function.
Yeah.
Where is this log 2 pi coming from? Like, y 2 pi?
Zeta prime 0, zeta 0.
Yeah. Okay. If you ask any analytic number theorist any question about this talk, they will wave their hands and say the explicit formula. And that's great, because it is, I mean, it's just, it's sort of like you specialize that. It's an amazing theorem. Well, there's your second formulation. Okay, let's move on to the third formulation. This one's kind of interesting because we deleted it from the book. But we forgot, in the book we talk about our four formulations. We have 1, 2, and 4. So people would write to us when they're done reading the book and they'd be like, I've been looking for the third formulation. Where is it? And yeah. Okay, so here's what it is. And I mean, it's pretty close to the explicit formula. It's the statement that if you take this staircase, this prime power staircase, and take its derivative in the sense of distributions, and then Fourier transform that, the result is a discrete distribution with spikes at the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, at the imaginary parts of the non-trivial zeros of zeta. So we had various formulations of that. And when I say is, that's in quotes, because there's some funny terms in the explicit formula that kind of mess this up. But here's the nice thing about this statement that we deleted from the book. It's really, really easy to see it explicitly in plots. And so I'll show you some of those plots. Okay? But just again, it just says that if you take the derivative of the prime power staircase, Fourier transform it, draw a plot, then you're going to see the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, which is kind of cool, because, I don't know, have you ever computed explicitly, you know, from scratch, zeros of the Riemann zeta function? Maybe not. But here's how you could. So what I've drawn on this slide is I just took the first four terms of this Fourier transform that I just mentioned. So if you differentiate the prime power staircase, you get a sum of Dirac delta functions with various weightings. And then you just apply Fourier transform to that. And I've just thrown away all but the first four terms. So it's just, I mean, you could easily plot this with any program. You could type it in if you wanted to. And here's what it looks like. Notice there's a bunch of ups and downs. I've deleted the bottom. We're just focusing on the top. And I've drawn some arrows there. Notice that the first big bump, after you ignore this one, is around 14, which may seem familiar to you if you think about the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. So these little red arrows, these are exactly at the imaginary parts of the non-trivial zeros of zeta. And notice they tend to correspond to where the spikes are, although it gets pretty messed up out here to the right. So like, you know, right around here, there's just one spike and there's two arrows. So that's kind of weird. So let's just draw exactly the same plot, but instead of using only four terms, we'll use 20 terms. So it's exactly the same thing, but summing up to for all prime powers, rather, not terms, but prime powers up to 20. So now if you look, there's, again, some problems as you go out, but at the beginning, the spikes exactly match up with where the red arrows are for a while. And here, the spikes aren't quite so distinguished, and out here, it's, again, a problem. So instead of just doing 20 terms, let's do, and I guess it should have been up to 20, let's go up to 500, so prime power is up to 500. And now it's really, really clear. Each of the zeros of zeta are exactly at one of the spikes in the picture, except for some annoying funny business at the beginning. So something that you could take home is there's a close relationship between the Fourier transform of the derivative of the prime power staircase and the discrete distribution that has support at the imaginary parts of the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. And I haven't mentioned complex numbers at all in any of this. Oh, and it goes the other way. If you take the distribution, you know, of course you need various weightings of the with support at the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, the thing we were just getting, and Fourier transform it again, you end up with this. So here I've used the first 1,000 imaginary parts of the zeros, and you'll see that there are spikes exactly at the prime powers with very predictable heights. So you just have this Fourier transform back and forth between these two sides. So we use that observation as kind of the central hook of our book, but we didn't state a version of RH in terms of that. Oh, and by the way, of course, long, long ago, Riemann untangled this observation, which is due to him, and obtained a formula directly for pi of x. So, you know, once you can approximate really well the diagonal, then you can approximate pi of x. So he wrote down functions r sub k of x that, so as you increase k, they become better and better approximations to pi of x. It's kind of like a Fourier series where you're truncating it at various points. And this is what you get if you draw r sub 25 right on top of the staircase of primes. They should look almost the same. And if you zoom in, so go a little farther up to around 300 and zoom in, this is what it looks like. The red staircase of primes is in the middle. The line in blue is r sub 50, so it's one of Riemann's approximations to pi of x. And the green line is li of x, which is a square root good approximation to pi of x, you know, assuming the Riemann hypothesis, but is nowhere near as good as what you get when you add in additional information coming from the zeros of zeta. And then finally, our fourth formulation of the Riemann hypothesis in the book, or really the third in the book, but our fourth version, is just the classical Riemann hypothesis. The zeros of the Riemann zeta function lie on the line real part of s equals 1/2. Okay, so the book, it's divided into different parts. And it just focuses on each of these different formulations of the Riemann hypothesis. We also spend a lot of time introducing the readers to distributions. So we don't just assume they know about distributions. Because again, they're high school students, half of them at least. The electrical engineers know about distributions, but not the high school students. They would get in trouble for using distributions. How about if I wave my hands and say the explicit formula? I think we have an enormous number of endnotes where we nail down, so we don't prove anything in the book, but we have endnotes. And so Andrew Granville wrote a really nice endnote that clarified some things very succinctly and beautifully. So I refer you to our endnotes and references. So. All right, so that's what's in the book. And now the next part of the talk is what happened with publishing the book. So we had written up much of this stuff, and we had this PDF that was on my website. And occasionally, Barry or I would give a course or give a talk or something drawing on these notes. But we didn't have a book beyond something that was just self-published. It was neat that people would discover it every once in a while, but we felt like it wasn't really getting significant traction. And there's kind of a missing quality step when you go from notes that you've written up to something that you publish in a book that is going to be in print and lots of people might read it, hopefully. I mean, not always. There are definitely books riddled with errors, but Barry wouldn't write a book like that. So, and I hope I wouldn't either. So. Will Hurst, he told us he was tired of printing out copies of the book and sending them to people, and so he strongly encouraged us to publish with a publisher. Didn't really give much direction beyond that, just publish with a publisher. Maybe publishing with publishers is in his blood. But so how do you find a publisher? We spent a lot of time trying to find a publisher, and if you write a book, you might as well, and I encourage you to spend some time thinking about it. Every book and person would fit better with, there's no one answer, you should use this publisher or that publisher. I've now published 3 books, one with the American Mass Society, one with Springer Verlag, and one with Cambridge University Press, and with 3 different editors. And in each case, it seemed like it was definitely the right thing to do, I think. So what fits for a particular problem depends on the person. And of course, Barry's published many books as well. So what we did was we talked to many editors, and probably the most efficient possible way to talk to lots of editors if you're going to publish a book is to go to the joint math meetings in January. You can sit down and talk for a half hour or whatever with 5 or 6 different editors. Many editors from, you're shaking your head, Anna's editor, yeah, so it's, but seriously, if you're thinking of publishing a book, talk to some editors at the JMM. I strongly recommend it. It's an extremely efficient way of seeing where your book will fit. And so we did that a lot, emails a lot, et cetera. And we looked at reputation, similar books. Some people would seem to be very, perfect fit. They were super enthusiastic, but then they would sort of not follow up at all. So it didn't, they were maybe just too busy or because they're so good. So we looked at all of that, and then a certain person emerged where the publisher was very reputable. They had similar books. She did follow up very, very well, and was able to sort of address a lot of our questions. We wanted the book to be extremely affordable, so we wanted the book to be $20 when published, to buy the print version. And so we had a lot of, so that would rule out certain publishers. So Caitlin Leach is at Cambridge University Press, and she was the person that was our editor. So we decided on the publisher. We decided we're going to actually publish the book, and then we spent years polishing it, and then we put the PDF online and just begged people to just said, hey, please find a typo. We dare you. And a lot of people looked at it, and some people, maybe 15 or 20, read the whole thing super, super carefully and sent us an enormous list of mistakes and typos and gotchas. If you're going to have a book read by a lot of people, it's really, really, and they're not, students in your class, it's really bad when they run across a typo or a little mistake. Like, they can just be going along fine, and then they hit a statement, which there's like one little letter out of place or something, and they get stuck on it, and they get really confused and frustrated, and have to write to you, or I don't know. It's just, it's not the greatest thing to do to people. So we really didn't want that to be the case. So we had random people that just saw this posting or our posting of the PDF give us lots of feedback about the mathematics. At the same time, the publisher had a copy editor read the book, and the copy editor had a lot of feedback on like the visual layout and where the commas should be and all that kind of thing. And they also did things like they got incredibly careful permissions for every single illustration in the book. Like they wanted to be, like we had, you know, we had like some image of Don Quixote from some book and we found it on Wikipedia, but they were like, yeah, we don't care that Wikipedia says that you can use that. We want to be absolutely certain. So we had to, you know, find some Don Quixote scholar to find a picture that had a proper copyright that would satisfy Cambridge. So unfortunately, it's washed out, but the caption in this image of Gauss, which, actually, is it totally washed out for you, or is it just the angle I'm looking at it from? Okay, it's washed out. So I will tell you what it says. It says, figure 10, Carl Friedrich Gauss, 1824 to 1908. Courtesy of the Smithsonian Libraries, Washington, D.C. So it shows two things. One, they were really careful to get a picture that they had permissions from the Smithsonian Libraries for. On the other hand, they put the, not the photographer, but they put the person that drew the portrait, they put his or her birthday and birth and death date. So it was the wrong date range. So that's the sort of thing that a publisher might not catch. A mathematician sees that and they're like, so I wonder what Gauss contributed to the, you know, the Hilbert problems or what did he think of the Hilbert problems? So you know that can't be right. But. Oops. So, just to emphasize, I've done this with all the books I've written. Try to get a wide audience to read for the mathematics, and then get the publisher, just set your expectations accordingly, and you'll be not disappointed. And then carefully look at the proofs that they give you back of the final drafts, because I don't know how Barry and I missed that, but we did. Let's see. Okay, the next thing is when you're going to make a book, and here's the book, you have to decide on a cover or come up with a cover. And so some sort of ideas for the components of our cover were, well, the title of the book. There's obvious stuff that should go on the cover. The title of the book, the names of the authors. And then you're like, well, it's, you know, about the Riemann hypothesis. So how about a plot of the Riemann zeta function? Maybe a portrait of Riemann. He's the star of the book, after all. And then maybe some really cool plots that illustrate all of the main ideas of the book. So of course, we had all these cover designs that had a million plots on them, and they're totally crazy. We also wanted to have kind of a classical look because it's partly about you know, getting yourself in the mindset of 1840. And there's a tension here between the publishers, the authors, and the marketers. So the authors want to put, you know, as much content, they want the cover of the book to have all these, to basically be the book, have all the content of the book in a way. And the marketer just wants a cover that catches your eye and makes you buy the book. So there's a tension, and the publisher has to keep the peace. So here's the cover that we created. It's a little hard to see, but it's a plot of the Riemann zeta function, and then it's some plot that involves some Fourier series, one of the ones I was illustrating earlier, and a big picture of Riemann in the middle, and our names. So it has many of the components that I just mentioned. Here's the cover that the actual book has, which you can see here. It has a lot of the same elements, but it really does look a lot different. It has like a more classical font, and it has our names. It has the Riemann zeta function, but flipped over sideways, and it looks pretty. The color blends into the color of the book, and the non-washed out version is right here. So, and then the back side has the picture of Riemann. Okay, so here's the back. So the back has a statement, has two quotes about the book, trying to sell the book. This is, of course, what the marketers want there. And a picture of Riemann, which is what we wanted. And again, I know you can barely see that that's a picture of Riemann. And then a little biography about each of us. So the quotes are from Will Hurst, who wanted us to publish the book, and David Mumford, who wrote a really nice blog post about an early PDF of the book that we had posted. Okay, so you've decided on the cover, you've decided on the content of the book, now you're going to produce the book. So what happens first is suddenly someone in a sort of broken English writes to you and says, please provide Word document. And you're like, wait a minute. So then there's a big back and forth, and they're like, what's LaTeX? And then, you know, and then it gets switched to a different person or something. And then you realize, you know, it's not a person sitting at Cambridge University Press at the university doing this. So that all got worked out pretty quickly, and we got more proper technical people in the, you know, they have their own very distinctive style, which of course you can't see here, but if you could, it looks a lot different than just like a random LaTeX book template. You know, it has really nice colors and stuff like that. There was an unfortunate physical issue with the very first few copies of the book that were printed, in that, I don't know, Barry called me up on the phone panicked one day. He's like, William, take your book out, open it flat. And the pages pop out. And I was like, what? And it was true. So, of course, they sent us the very first copies of the book. And if you look on Amazon.com at the reviews, we don't have a perfect rating. And part of that is because some people are very annoyed that their book started popping apart. You know, like a book, one thing it's supposed to do is not have pages go flying like a deck of cards. So we told Cambridge, they addressed the issue and had to like get the people that make the book to destroy all these copies and then, you know, redo it. So there were a few unfortunate issues, and also I think there were some issues with the Kindle version that pissed off readers, where the quality wasn't quite good enough. And again, we told Cambridge University Press, and they fixed it and made a new Kindle version that was much better. They were really good about being supportive and marketing the book, you know, advertising it, et cetera. And if you're considering publishing with Cambridge, in my experience, it was very positive overall from beginning to end. It got published, so here's the Amazon page. And one thing that made me very happy is the paperback. It says starting at $14.68. So we really didn't want this to be some book where the publisher is like, oh, it's gonna be $50 or $40 for the paperback. So it's a reasonable price. Can I do that? And there's, you know, lots of reviews there. So here's one by Oliver, whoever that is, which says, short, gorgeous, in spring, inspiring, and affordable. So, I mean, that's what we wanted when we, you know, wrote the book. We wanted it to be short, gorgeous, inspiring, and affordable, and we succeeded, according to this reviewer. It's interesting, by the way, I mentioned there are a lot of other books on RH. The review that this person wrote starts with listing like 7 or 8 books on the Riemann hypothesis. And one nice thing that the reviewer says near the bottom is that Barry Mazur and I have the best street credibility of the recent authors of books on the Riemann hypothesis. So. So you can celebrate Barry's street credibility. there are also some magazine and blog reviews, like Peter Sarnak recently wrote a review that's in the bulletins, and he says, we make effective use of technology and do a marvelous job of integrating all this information into an exposition of the underlying math. And Avner, who just introduced me, wrote a review that recently appeared in American Math Monthly. There's a nice review in the MAA. John Baez, who writes tons of stuff about physics, wrote a nice blog mentioning our post, and Kathy O'Neill wrote something on her site where she was actually annoyed that we mentioned people as much as we did. It would have been even better if it focused on the ideas more and the people less. So, can't satisfy everybody. Royalties. So, we sold copies and they gave us money, which was kind of nice. So that's another thing that happens when you publish a book rather than just self-publishing it on your website. So. Each time I've written a book, I've taken the royalty check and got something that would mean something to me. So like I got a really nice an SLR camera once. And this time I'm paying for expenses for a puppy. So in case you're curious, probably she'll eat a copy of this book if I get near her though. Finally, another thing that might happen if you're lucky, and this has never happened to me before, but last month we got not very long ago, April 26th, we got an email from somebody at Cambridge saying that they're going to translate our book into Japanese and then sell it there. So that's exciting. I've never had you know, anything I did, or any book translated into another language. And I think, Barry, your imagining square root of minus 15 was translated, so you have some experience with this. And then finally, what do we plan to do going forward? So it would be nice to make a fully online interactive version of all the plots that appear in the book. There's lots and lots of, you know, stuff in there where you could really, you know, nicely work with it. And we kind of always planned to do that. We made all the code open. But right now, if you want to, you know, reproduce all the plots in the book, you go to some GitHub repo and you download a bunch of Cython code and you compile it in Sage and then run it. And it's kind of a painful experience. And it would be much better to have something that doesn't require any technical skill whatsoever. More like the, where you just sort of like go to a website and start browsing and dragging sliders and so on. So that's one thing. We also have this ongoing research project that involves trying to understand how explicit the explicit formula is in practice. And it, of course, it's very similar to what we do in the book, but aimed at more at elliptic curves and trying to understand guesses based on statistical properties of the AP, what the rank of an elliptic curve is. Okay. So that is my talk. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
Yes, Keith.
Have you ever had anyone come up to you after writing a book to say, so this is why the monocost is such a big deal?
So Keith's question is, has anyone ever contacted me after I wrote the book and said, this is why the Riemann hypothesis is true? So one thing I knew going into writing this book is I was going to paint a big target on my back for the rest of my life for every math crank ever. So yeah, I do get a regular stream of proofs of the Riemann hypothesis, if that's what you're asking. I don't know if you're, Barry, if it increased for you, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, you don't write a book about RH without expecting that. But they're nice. I mean, the one thing about people that, retired electrical engineers that prove RH is they're generally very polite and, yeah, they don't, like, actually come up to you, fortunately, usually. Other questions? Oh, back right. Yeah, you've, great. Oh, Bella. Her name's Bella. Beautiful in Italian. So, and she's 3 months old. Yes?
Did you and Professor Mazur ever get turf wars over book content, given the dual system?
Ah, yeah. So somehow, like, so his question is, were there turf wars over what would go into the book? I think, let's see. There's like every single thing involved with writing a book, there's all kinds of little tension, just like with the cover design. And, but no, I don't, no. I mean, I guess the book wrote itself and it used us to write it and it took like 14 years. But no, I don't remember anything like that at all. It's very good. Barry's a great collaborator, in case you're wondering. anyone who's written anything with him will agree with that. Yes?
So going back to the crane thing, I have a question about the other group.
So I haven't got anything from high school students, though whenever a high school student contacts me, it's really convenient to have this book to give them, because, you know, it's nice to be able to give a book. So I just gave one to a high school student a few weeks ago. Famous people, so John Baez, who I mentioned, he wrote a blog post about the book. He's a, I would say, very famous in mathematical physics. I remember reading tons of stuff he wrote, like when I was an undergrad. So I was super excited to see him notice the book. I was thrilled that, you know, Peter Sarnak took an interest in it, but, you know, he's a mathematician, so, yeah. But John Baez, he's not a mathematician.
Well, electronic engineers.
Yeah. They really
were sort of fascinated by the idea of making such extensive computations.
Especially, I was especially interested in high school, because sometimes I read a book,
You know, it's possible. We've gotten a lot of nice emails and It's possible some are from high school students, so they just didn't say. Let's see. Other questions? Yes, Joe.
Did you manage to get the publisher to commit to a low retail price, or just that they would promise to do the best they could?
So his question is, did we get a low retail price in the contract legally, or was it more of a gentle person's agreement? And my recollection, God, I can't remember. I think it was a gentle person's agreement, right?
I do too.
Yeah, yeah, that's what
we kept pushing.
Yeah. But it worked in the end. The price was good, but yeah, I don't remember it being mailed down. There were a lot of things we kind of wanted, but it didn't quite get in the contract. But you can ask for anything in any contractual negotiation. Next question. Yeah.
Are there any problem sets? Is there a solutions manual? And is there any problem involving writing code?
I taught a summer course for high school students in 2007, and I did give them a lot of problems and stuff involving writing code. I haven't looked at it since I put up the website in 2007. If you read, we do have implicit problems in the book. For example, this person says, while Van Kratz has many nice exercises, another book, an exercise of Maserstein led me to abandon other things for a couple of weeks. Since it was so captivating. So be careful. So I warn you, there are exercises, but they're more stated informally in the text rather than, I mean, it's not designed as is as a textbook to use for a class. Such material, maybe that would be a good thing to add as, a future project would be to make it usable as a textbook as part of a class. But that doesn't exist, no. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the other one did come out of a course. So maybe you could use that book for exercises. Yeah. Yes, Michael?
Related research, did it take a different form at the end of the process than it might have at the beginning? In other words, did the process of writing this book affect the direction of this related research?
So the end of the process isn't here. but the related research is not.
No, but I mean, yeah. The process of writing the book, mm-hmm. that in itself have an effect.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, very much. I mean, we're really surprised by the direction of the book, which was really caused by the mathematics and the pictures.
I guess the idea that the explicit formula is, in the end, really explicit in the sense that computations of a reasonable sort converge shockingly well. I mean, so you can try to do that in other contexts. But I suppose the analysts know this, it just, we didn't know it.
Yeah, we're not officially analytic number theorists, Barry and I. Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Let me remind everyone about the reception from 5 to 7 this evening in the fourth floor of